Myanmar's military authorities are preparing to hold an election Sunday that they hope will legitimize their five-year hold on power, but which their opponents have called a sham.
Polls are open in Myanmar's first general election since a military coup in 2021. But the United Nations and rights groups say the process is neither free nor fair.
People in Myanmar are casting their ballots in the first election since a military coup ousted the civilian government in 2021. It's taking place amid a civil war and one of Asia's worst humanitarian crises.
Myanmar is all set to hold elections for the first time in 5 years, but this is not a normal polling process. The ruling junta is scrutinizing the upcoming elections and has also chosen a party to back.
Myanmar's elections are only happening in parts of the country that the military control, and some estimates say that could be as little as 30%. Millions of people are going to be disenfranchised.
Thank you for taking time to listen to today's episode. As I'm sure you know, the current crisis in Myanmar is extremely concerning, and we appreciate that you're taking the time to stay informed. There's even value in just becoming a little more aware and helping to inform others. So we would like to encourage you to please consider sharing this episode so that more people may learn about what is really happening in the country now. It's just absolutely critical to ensure that this issue remains present in public discourse everywhere. But now, let's get on to the interview itself.
Discussing today at least some aspects of the three-part sham elections that were recently held in Myanmar to a very unsurprising quote-unquote result. I am joined today by Yagu, whose organization Myanography has released quite an extensive report and is continuing to release additional reports based not only on the realities of the election itself, but more importantly, on the lived experiences of the Myanmar people who have to operate within the military system and do not have the luxury of avoiding the elections and boycotting them. So before we get into all of those many complicated details, I want to thank you very much for joining us and sharing your insight and sharing your research. And we will link to that research below this episode so people can access it. First of all, I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself for the audience.
Okay. Thank you very much, Inside Myanmar, for collaboration with us. For this means collaborations with Myanmar people's resistance against dictatorship. So my name is Yagu. I'm a co-founder and leader of one of the Myanmar research organizations, which is a non-profit research organization. Our organization started since around 2011. We used to be an accredited research organization operating inside Myanmar until 2021 coup. And since 2021, we continue doing our research, both inside and outside Myanmar, and we are now operating in under other names, different names, and especially mostly we use a pseudonym. Mm. Yeah, so for this research regarding on election, the so-called general election, the 2025 Myanmar election, we conducted the research in collaborations with researchers based in Myanmar's all states and regions, and we call them community ethnographers. So in collaborations with them and in collaborations with other civil society organizations in Myanmar, we conducted this research. This research, we started conducted the research 2 months before the elections, and we community based ethnographically, we monitor every phase of the research, as the every phase of the elections, as the election is divided into three phases. So I also would like to introduce the concept of ethnography. It is an ethnographic mode of inquiry. It is an approach to studying Myanmar society from within by documenting life experience, everyday practices, social relations, political meanings, and cultural logics across the country's diverse communities. And here, the notion of communities extends beyond geographically or ethnically bounded groups to include social formations connected through shared political engagements, cultural practices, livelihoods, or other forms of collective life. Importantly, studying Myanmar from within does not imply that such research must be conducted exclusively by Myanmar nationals. Rather, it emphasizes an approach grounded in close engagement with local context, perspective, and life worlds. This is the introduction.
I appreciate that very much. And so I want to delve a little bit into what you just said, because this is a very interesting topic within the field of research itself. How do we approach research? What do we look at? And of course, when we look at something like the election, the majority of people, the majority of reports, the majority of analyses are going to focus on things like the election results, where were the elections held, how many people participated. So numbers, statistics, locations, maps, raw, calculable, quantitative data. And your approach, this myanography approach, as you say, is an ethnographic approach that focuses on qualitative information. So looking at the actual experiences and the actual realities of the Myanmar people who are living the things that we are analyzing and reporting on. So the first question is obviously, why is this so significant? Why did you undertake this quite extensive study? And for those who are curious, the title of this particular study is Voting in Terror. Quite appropriate. Why did you choose to undertake this study, and why is it so important that we do this study from a qualitative and ethnographic perspective.
Yes, thank you. Actually, ethnography in collaborations with ethnographer, community-based ethnographer, we started studying Myanmar people's experience under this very oppressive military dictatorship since a few months after the military coup. We organized the researchers and civil society members who based in different parts of the countries, and we started the research. But we actually started reporting starting from 2022 June. Since then, we reported every 6 months. So, as this is the ethnographic research, the community researchers with our technical support, every day of their life is actually a research data collection, but they report every 6 months. So the community researchers living inside their communities and in their everyday life, they recorded how Myanmar people in their everyday life experienced the oppressions under the military dictatorship, very oppressive and brutally oppressive military dictatorship.
Mm.
Yeah. This in fact is also very much important in terms of the research knowledge and it in terms of the epistemological values. For us, because we feel unsafe, we relocated to other countries, but those who are living inside the countries, they keep doing research in their everyday life. And then they share how is the life of the people under the oppressions. Yeah.
And so the very important follow-up to this
yes.
is, of course, how do you do this? Because we know that within Myanmar, obviously in the major cities, you still have electricity, you still have internet, people are on social media, Facebook, WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram, all these sorts of things. But I would imagine that doing this kind of work, collecting this type of information from people within the country is dangerous, and people would be at risk if they collaborate. So how, if it's safe to discuss it, how do you go about collecting this information? How do you go about convincing people to collaborate and share this information with you at all at a time when the military is trying to crack down on any negative information coming out of the country?
After the coup, many of the ethnographic researchers, the community ethnographers, actually, even including us, we experience the very life changing, the dramatically, the immediate changing of our life, and some of them are very some of them experience violence, very big, extreme violence. So we reflected those life-changing experience, and then we recognized that even if this group of peoples, like around like 20 peoples, they have this life-changing experience in the immediate time. We sometimes call it this is a very forceful political rupture. So we started this way. We started doing reflections only of our life to understand why the people in Myanmar they stand up and they wage this very forceful resistance against this this military coup. So this kind of things, very anthropological ways of learning about our life. This actually, I think, one way to convince the people. So by this kind of reflections of our own life, actually makes all of us convinced that every day of our life and our life tackling of these oppressions is very important to understand the dictatorship, not only military dictatorship, but the dictatorship and authoritarianism. So I think this kind of ways makes the community ethnographers convinced and then to participate. And many of them are also CDMRs. So they, they know how important it is. And here in this research regarding on elections, one thing it is very important to note is the difference of the knowledge between those who living inside Myanmar and those who living outside of Myanmar. So normally this community-based ethnographic research, we normally talk about more political issues like local governance, the security issues, the relationship with different authorities, and and their livelihoods. And then even though the election approaches, for those who live outside, they are not that interested in elections, even though they automatically reject these elections, considering as a sham election. But for those who live inside Myanmar, it's different. So this is actually informed by our community ethnographers. They mentioned that even though they don't support the election, they are now being faced with the situations that they can no longer ignore the elections, and many of them and their families started thinking about voting in the upcoming elections because of this everyday implicit and explicit oppressions, threats from the authorities under the junta. So the community ethnographers, yes, they know the risk, security risk, of doing research under this very brutally oppressive regime, military regime. So they're very careful about their security, but it is actually they are just learning, studying as ordinary people, and they themselves are also ordinary people living in the community like other ordinary people. So every day of their life is a research. Even though they don't need to take notes or doing interviews, but every day the interactions with other people about their perceptions and their knowledge about the local authorities, local economy, everything is actually counted as a very valuable data of life experience of the people of Myanmar under the oppressive junta.
And we can certainly understand how vital gathering this information would be. And I don't want to feel like I'm delaying getting into the important information, but I also want to make sure that we bring everybody up to speed. So with regards to these elections themselves, which is the context that your report is focusing on, and again, for those who are interested, the report is titled Voting in Terror, Studying Myanmar's 2025 Election Through Community-Based Ethnography. The election, as we recall, was run in three separate phases. Now, we know that this was a sham election. We're not sort of debating that. But nevertheless, this was a slightly unusual approach to the election. And as you were alluding to, and I'm definitely going to try to get into that a little bit deeper going forward, the people had already started considering this question of, are we going to participate in this election? Are we going to be part of this? Even though the people know that this election is fraudulent. So what I would like for you to do is, if you can describe for our audience what this election was like, why was it done in three phases? And from the perspective of the people in Myanmar, what were they hearing? What was the messaging about this election, the propaganda, if you will? What was being told to them? What would be going through their minds as the first, second, and third phases of this election are approaching?
Many of the people living on the ground inside Myanmar, many of them, they didn't even know the election will be implemented in three phases. And many of them also didn't know that they have to vote by machine, by device. All they know is the election is going to take place. And this actually coming through the local authorities, you know. They started talking about the elections when the people went to them to get the endorsement, the local authorities' endorsement, which now require as one of the requirements for travel, for mobilities, and for guest list, for registrations of the guest list. In Myanmar, as far as I remember, around 1 year after the coup, the people are to do to register the guest list. This actually is the registration of the guest list is has been actually was canceled during the transition political transition period from 2015. After 2015, it's being canceled. So for many years, it's been canceled. But now the military government reintroduced this this rule of making registration of the guest list. This means whoever come to your home to stay, it is a must for you to make a guest list. But there are also many people in Myanmar, and now many more people are required to do this registration of the guest list because they don't have a family household registration in a certain area they are living. And now many more people have a displacement because of the war, no? So those people in different cities like Mandalay, Yangon, they are living on a registration of the guest list. So it is very actually vital to get the registration of the guest list extended every 2 weeks or every month. Some of the work administrator, local authorities, they require their people to even extend every week, of their guest list. So it is very important. So when you, when the election approaches, when the people went to the local authorities to extend their guest list, then they told them that, oh, the election is approaches, blah, blah, blah. And then you have to register your name for the elections. And then why they are having that conversations, they put some kind of hints that, oh, I remember you. You are a CDM. And then your CDM guys, I have your list, CDM list, in our hands, and then for a little while, and then he also added like that, oh, your husband, I remember he moved from another region, he is also about the age of military conscriptions. So those kind of things, you know, coming to the people as anxieties and fears about the elections. Or what if I don't vote? What are they going to do? What if they don't extend my registration of the guest list? What if they include my sons on husbands to include in the conscription list, even though we pay the money, we bribe them, right? So those kind of things are little by little coming to the people, and then this is actually the reasons that made the people to consider to vote around like 2 months before the elections.
So it's a little bit subtle, not very subtle, but it sounds almost like the mafia when they want to make threats without making any threats. It's not that people are being actually taken from their houses, forced at gunpoint to go to polling places and participate in the elections. It's that, if I'm understanding you correctly, there are so many ways and so many reasons for which the average person in Myanmar and their families could be punished by the regime, yes. getting permission to do basic things, you know. And I think anyone who's lived in Myanmar will remember just how administratively heavy Myanmar is, and everything requires a paper, and you have to go to the, you know, the local township office, and then you have to go to the other office. It's a very, very administration heavy country. And it is therefore, if I grasp the implication, it is therefore an act of performative compliance that people would go and participate in this election, not because they genuinely feel that the election is real, not because they think that the election outcome can be affected, but rather because they want to not give the military a reason to target them and target their families. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. And I also would like to add that some of the people have more threats than some other. For example, especially IDPs. Some of the IDPs even bluntly face the threats of the local administrator. Some of the cases that we study in Tangu, the local administrator called the IDPs there, and then they openly threat. We know that how many of the people are in your family, in your household list, and how many of them are now at the age of the conscription. So if you don't vote, then those people will be included in the conscriptions, those kind of things. And then another example, which is also more obvious a trick of the authorities they used on the IDPs. So they asked the IDPs to come to the administrative office, for example, those IDPs in Hakha Township, Hakha Town, which is in the Chin State. They are asked to come to the township, you know, administrative office to get rights support that from actually international communities. And then the IDPs who came, who went to the administrative office to get their rights, then they are asked to vote instead of providing them with their rights. And then they said after the vote, oh, the rights has not come yet. It will come at the end of the month. So those kind of things also happen. Yeah.
So there are a lot of ways. And I think that conscription aspect seems to be a very strong theme and something that people are very much terrified of. Even as you say, this is fascinating. Even with IDPs, you say that they can be conscripted. That feels very, very strange to me. If someone is internally displaced, the implication to me is that such a person does not have a formally recognized address. They would not necessarily be entered into the records of that particular township. And in addition to that, if you are an IDP in Myanmar, it is most likely the case you are an IDP because the military destroyed your home. Mm. So to threaten to conscript you to serve in the same military that destroyed your home is not only cruel, but also stupid. Why would these people in any way, shape, or form be beneficial to the military. They would be a liability. They would be likely to defect. They would be likely to desert. They would be likely to engage in sabotage and malicious compliance and all of these sorts of things. So I would wonder if there's clarification on this. It seems that these threats of things like conscription don't even necessarily have to follow an official normal process that you would normally expect to say, well, you know, you can come to my house because I'm registered at this house in this township. You know my age. You know all of these details about me in the way that you can be registered to vote. But even if you're an IDP living in an IDP camp, with no formal address, the military is still threatening you to say, we can come to your camp that we forced you to flee into and abduct your children and force them into the military. Is that a realistic representation of what's going on?
Yes. And in many cases, the IDPs are not living in a camp. For example, the IDPs in some of the towns like Yangon, Mandalay, Sagay, and Tangu, they are living in at the house of the relatives, but it is not a camp. But for the local authorities, they know that they are IDPs because somewhere inside their township or regions, there's a fight, and then they come up on the town, and then they live in this residential areas together with their friends and relatives. So they know that they are the IDPs, and then they are living on the guest registration list. Yeah, so this is the way they know them. So even if the administrators, they didn't go down to the IDP camps or the particular places where IDP are camp, they use that the tools of the threats.
So, I mean, this is quite perverse. And coming back to your research document itself, one of your key findings, just to reiterate what you're saying, is that the IDPs are particularly at risk and they are facing significantly greater pressure to participate in the elections and to do these performative actions of compliance to keep the military happy. Just sort of highlighting that being an IDP isn't just hard because you don't have a stable home and you've lost your community. It's also hard because you continue to be more heavily targeted because you are an IDP. Mm-hmm. So it's quite brutal. So let's move to the other. So your paper has 8 key findings. And as we said, one of those key findings was the IDPs. One of those key findings is that average everyday citizens had to consider voting even 2 months before the election, as you say, because there are these implicit threats that if you do not comply with this election, if you do not legitimize this election by participating, then you will be targeted and your family will be targeted. So let's look then at some of the other groups that are highlighted here. So you make a specific example here with government employees. Mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting one because government employees already, even before the coup, government employees often understood that they were going into a system which is still largely run by military appointed officials. So there is this sort of view that government workers in Myanmar, especially those who did not do CDM, are in some way, shape, or form in favor of the military regime post-coup. Now, of course, this is not the case necessarily. But this is a general feeling and a general implication. So it is surprising that you make this specific point that government staff specifically felt that they had no choice because of how close they are to the government, because of how identifiable they are from the perspective of the military. So what can you tell us about the conflict, the internal conflict with government workers who maybe do not want to participate in this election?
For government employees, actually, some of our researchers are also CDMRs. So they use, because this means they used to work at the government departments, and of course they have friends and their relatives, even their relatives, they still working for the government. So they heard from those people that they don't want to participate in the elections, and many government employees, particularly the school teachers, are all the time assigned to work on the elections, especially at the polling stations. So those government employees, most of them, they don't like the junta. They don't want to vote. But it is very strictly ways of instructions to get their vote. For example, school teachers, their headmasters ask to make sure that their names are on the voters' registration list. So in order to enforce that, even the head mistress or the headmasters, they ask the name not only of the school teachers working at their school, but also the names of their family members to give the eligible voter list of the school teachers' family members. In many areas are given to the headmaster, and then the headmaster to the township education officers. So those kind of instructions are coming to the government departments. So it is very hard for them to resist the government and against the election. So, but they also have the fear that because the people and the resistant forces don't support the elections, they fear that if the resistant forces use violence at the polling stations, the school teachers, their life are at risk. So those kind of things, they have to, they experience. So they don't want to vote, they don't want to participate, but the administrative instructions and scrutiny, I would say, force them to vote. And then sometimes it is very, very clear that if a certain department or sessions, if they vote and whom they vote for. So, for example, in Chin State Hakka, most of the voters, most of the people who voted are very apparent that it is the government employee. So inside the ballot box, if they vote none other than the military-backed party, USDP, then they will be they will have problems. So they have to vote, and they have to vote the military-backed party, mostly, USDP,
So even on that, because this was another one of the findings, so I want to look at a couple of the findings, and we'll sort of combine them. So your key finding number three was generally a lack of faith in the ability of the military to even hold an election properly. Obviously, in a sham election, it's very easy. They don't need to prepare. They don't have to worry about security and logistics. They can just put up a pretend voting booth, and they're just going to put fake ballots in the boxes anyway. It doesn't matter. But there's nevertheless, you're saying that there's a general lack of faith that the military has the time, the skill, the preparation to run a democratic fair election. You note as well in finding number six that the people don't trust the electronic voting system. Mm-hmm. And of course, we also have the pretty serious issue here that people don't have anyone to vote for, which you highlight in your key finding number seven. So let's address some of these. So first and foremost, let's go to the electronic voting system, because Myanmar is a country where historically technological adoption was quite slow. The military deliberately kept technological adoption slow. And we saw this rapid expansion of technology during the Thein Sein period and then during the NLD period. And some of that was very good for the country. Some of it was not good for the country. But nevertheless, we have that. And Myanmar has rapidly technologically advanced. And of course, during COVID, a lot of technological innovations, you know, contactless card payments and things like this started to get rolled out for safety reasons. But electronic voting is a sort of a new frontier. Myanmar is one of those countries, in fact, where the indelible ink on the fingertip as a way of checking who has voted and who has not voted, which in many parts of the world is seen as a very low-tech solution, is emblematic of democracy and is emblematic of the electoral process. Like for anyone who's followed Myanmar social media, a cartoon hand with a painted little finger raised is the mark of elections. It is the mark of democracy in a lot of circles. Mm. And so moving to this electronic system is quite a leap. But you're saying that the people do not have confidence in the electronic system. And I wonder, do they not have confidence in the electronic system because it's different? Do they not have confidence in the electronic system because it is an electronic system that is being rolled out by the military? Where do these attitudes come from?
I think this is the electronic system. It is implemented by the military. And in this time of political environment, they don't trust, I would say. So, and then they are not also, as you say, it is electronic frontiers or something like that, right? So they are not familiar with this kind of electronic things, but especially they don't trust because it is implemented by military, and because they, I mean, regardless of either electronic or non-electronic ways of voting, the people won't trust the elections. They know that the Myanmar army, the junta, will implement the election at any cost in order to end their legitimacy, particularly external legitimacy, no. So the people know that they will do the election at any cost, and at any of the means of the voting, they won't trust. They know that the military will do something, something fraudulent ways to get their vote. So this trust coming from this mistrust on the junta.
And I suppose this is reinforced by the next issue here, and that is that there is no one to vote for. So let's look at the lead up to the election. Unless I'm mistaken, what we saw was the people had to register again to be eligible to vote. And so large numbers of people have lost their voting rights who previously were able to vote, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. In addition to this, the political parties had to go through a new electoral registration process, and mm-hmm. a very large number of political parties have been rendered unlawful or ineligible to run. And in addition to that, many politicians or people who hope to become politicians lost their right to run for election as well. And so this left us with a situation where the military has deliberately tried to remove people who have anti-military sentiments from the voting rolls, in addition to what we've already discussed, that a lot of people felt, you know, compelled to participate in this election and so on. But they're removing people that they know are not going to be in support of them, and they have eliminated the existence of parties that are in direct opposition to the military regime. So you don't have to vote for USDP. There are many political parties you can vote for, none of them good. Mm-hmm. And so this leaves us with this very difficult situation. So how does that affect the thinking of people? I would imagine this reinforces the idea that this election is fraudulent and it's irrelevant. But one thing that I'm wondering is, does this make people feel more confident in participating in the election? Because they look at this and they say they've come out with this electronic system, they've thrown people off the voting rolls, they've invalidated political parties, they've barred specific politicians from running in this election. It is so obvious that this election is fake. It is so obvious that this election is fraudulent. It doesn't matter if I participate. It doesn't matter if I vote USDP to protect myself and protect my family, because no one will respect the result of this election anyway, because everyone can see that this is a lie. What is the thinking of the people in Myanmar when they're confronted with this information?
Many people, when they started thinking about their participation in the elections, they have the thinking that regardless of they vote or not, USDP will win. And then they know that the junta will do anything to win the USDP party. That's why they consider that, okay, we will vote not to have problems from the junta. Okay, so let's vote at least one or two people from our families vote. They consider like that. But in many cases that we study, the people consider how to cancel, how their votes, how their ballots cancel. So in what way will their ballots be canceled? They are thinking, if I push the electronic buttons two or three times, will that be canceled, my ballots? Or, those kind of things, you know. Mm. But at the same time, many people in the communities that we study, they think about, okay, we will vote for not having any problems on my families. We will vote for any parties except USDP.
I know you don't want to focus too much on the electoral outcome, but of course we still saw, the USDP got, a lot of the vote.
Yeah.
Surprise, 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 obviously, yeah. But this raises another very important ancillary question to this. I know that historically elections in Myanmar have been done under horrific conditions. And the 1990 election was probably the first and the last time that the military actually tried to run a legitimate election, because they were so deluded that they thought that they would win. And then, of course, they lose and they put Aung San Suu Kyi in prison and all this sort of stuff. And so we fast forward, we see the fraudulence in the 2008 constitutional referendum, we see the fraudulence in the 2010 election, and then, of course, in 2015, they finally allowed an election to give them an excuse to transition, to a pseudo democracy and all those things. But the issue at hand is that I have heard claims of people who voted, but they voted in military camps, or they voted in polling places that were run by the military for quote unquote security. And they complained that they didn't have privacy when they voted, that they would have to vote and fill out their voting sheets within view of the military personnel, and that they were legitimately afraid that if they didn't vote for the USDP, that they could be targeted. Is that a practice that we continue to see in this particular election? Were people still complaining, and were people upset that that they didn't even feel that, okay, I want to participate in this fraudulent election to protect my family, but I can't even fill out my ballot without somebody watching me? How bad was the privacy and the legitimacy of at least the voting process?
At the polling stations, our research don't found this kind of things, but we have to point out the advanced voting. What we found out is, we found some of them 2 months before the elections. There's a kind of like a possibilities of playing with this advanced votings, because during our study, 2 months before the elections, for example, like in Pinlong Township, the administrators, the township level administrator, they started taking the list of the students who are 18 years old, the eligible for the vote for the elections, right? So then one of the students' mothers asked why they are asking. Then they learned that it is for the advanced votings. So we started doubting about playing of the advanced votings. And then the following rounds, what we found out is the administrator, they collected advance vote even though the people don't inform them that they are going to do advance votings. For example, in the previous elections, for example, my family, they asked the administrator, we would like to do advance votings. Then only in that case, they came to our house and then they collect the advance votings, right? But in this time, the village administrator, the ward administrator, they went to some of the house who have the old age people living, they ask for the advanced votings. So in that case, the people have some kind of fear and insecurity to vote at the presence of the authorities at their home. So those kind of things happen. Those kind of things we found out, in our study.
So I think it's really good that you raised that, because in a lot of places, in a lot of countries, I live currently in Australia, for example, I always advanced vote. It's called pre-voting in Australia. But the way that pre-voting works in Australia is vastly different. At least some of the polling places run by the government will be available 2 or 3 weeks before the election. They will just be open from 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock, and you can walk in anytime. You don't have to ask. You don't have to get a special dispensation or permission. They are just available for you to go, and you do your voting in the same place that everybody else does their voting on the election day. Or alternatively, you can mail your vote through the post office. And this, again, is a thing that happens in many countries. And you can request a mail-in ballot and you can receive it. But at no point in any of this would a government representative come into your house. This is absurd. In fact, I have even voted in Australia outside of my voting district, and they have been very careful to ensure that they give the envelope to me so that I can put my vote inside the envelope safely and securely, and then that envelope is put into a separate envelope so that it can be mailed to my voting district. I can be verified, and then they can remove the inside envelope to anonymize me so that nobody can connect my vote to my identity. All of these precautions are standard. So when we talk about advanced voting in Myanmar, I think it is crucial what you've pointed out, that advanced voting in Myanmar doesn't just mean that you can go to the voting place a week before the election and cast your ballot. It means government representatives will come into your home and you will have to fill in your electoral ballot in front of them. And this makes it a fundamentally different red flag, a danger, when we say people are being compelled into advanced voting because of how dangerous that is. So I very much appreciate that you raised that point and you explained why it is so critical that we understand how advanced voting works. What I want to do here, though, I want to transition a little bit, because we have obviously been focusing on the people inside Myanmar. And I know that the thrust of your research and the epistemological underpinnings of your research is trying to understand the lived experiences of people in Myanmar. And I think very much to your credit, your organization's credit, this line is being drawn between Myanmar people within Myanmar and Myanmar people overseas. And not to diminish the opinions and the insights and the views of the Myanmar people overseas, but fortunately for them, although they are suffering in many ways, they do not have to directly suffer under the military regime. And so the attitudes are different. So if possible, I would like if you can explain to us, what are the differences in the attitudes that are held by the Myanmar people in Myanmar towards this election and the attitudes that are held by the Myanmar people who are outside of Myanmar towards this election?
For Myanmar people outside of Myanmar, what I mean is those groups resisting the junta, right? I mean, for them, it is out of the question. Election is out of the question. It is a sham election. In this time of oppression, and in this time of ruling the country by arm. I mean, the election is, you know, totally the sham election, you know. So it's the totally reject. But the people inside Myanmar, they have to accommodate these oppressions. And this oppression is very, very near to them. The local authorities, and then the paramilitary, what we call is Pusorti. It is actually the stooges of the Myanmar army. So they are living inside the communities. So they really have to care about those authorities and the oppressions. So they have to, their everyday life is to accommodate those kind of oppressions in their everyday life. So, and then another thing here we have to count is now the ordinary people in Myanmar, they have been encountered with this profound economic hardships as well. So if anyone of their family members are arrested or conscripted, then their situations will be totally different. Totally different in a very negative ways. They are already too much. So they even though they don't like Myanmar army, they will find very subtle ways of resistance. We have to understand that they will contribute their income to the resistant groups and forces, but on the surface, they will accommodate everyday expressions, everyday oppressions that is very close to them. So we have to understand their everyday life. It is not that they are happy. They like that. They like the government. But they have to practically live with this violently, brutally oppressive regimes. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it's more than simply what we're discussing, the realities, the ins and the outs of how the election worked and why the election worked. I think there's this undercurrent of understanding and compassion that we have to realize that there are legitimate Myanmar citizens who went to the election voluntarily and cast their ballots for the USDP. And they made the decision to do this. But they're not doing this because they believe in the regime. They're not doing this because they believe in the military dictatorship. They're doing this because they feel that they have no choice to protect themselves and protect their families. And that even if we do not see proof of these extreme cases of the military forcibly taking people at gunpoint to polling places and forcing them to vote in public, that doesn't mean that people who participate in this election are doing it truly voluntarily. They're still being compelled. They're just being compelled in different ways and subtle ways. So I do very much appreciate that we have this type of insight and that we have this type of understanding of why a person would contribute. And I think I have to ask the opposite, though, just to be sure. In your research, And I'm sure that your research obviously skews more towards the people who are already leaning against the military dictatorship. But in your research, do you come across people who expressed any level of optimism that maybe the election is going to be free and fair, or people who maybe feel that, well, if the military wins and they establish a military civilian government, then that is going to improve the situation and is going to bring about stability and peace. Do you encounter people who view this election with any true level of optimism and positive attitude? Or do you only really see people who feel that they have to pretend that this election is a good thing in order to stay safe?
We don't see this is a optimistic. We don't see any optimistic, but some of the people expect that after the elections, and they know that the military will do anything to have the USDP party victory, then that's why the people expected that there will be a little bit more calm down and less restrictions. For example, like travel restrictions, scrutinies, those kind of things, and conscriptions. This could be lessons after the elections. Some of the people mentioned about that. Some of them mentioned this kind of things are also in the highly conflict affected areas, and some of the IDPs in highly affected areas like Kurini, dry zone, where the people frequently suffer the airstrikes. So they think that now they have airstrikes, heightened in a number of airstrikes, because the army, the junta, they want to implement the election in many areas as possible, so that they would like to totally wipe out the resistance army, some of the areas. That's why they use more airstrikes. And then another perceptions relating to that is some of the IDPs in highly conflict affected areas with suffering from airstrike, more airstrike has been experienced around the elections. They think that the junta make more airstrikes so that the people in the areas living in the resistance control area, they move back to the town when the junta make airstrikes on the resistance control area. Then they got the vote from those IDPs, move back to the town. So those kind of things are also perceptions of the IDPs and conflict affected areas. Okay, after the elections, this kind of airstrikes and military operations, consecutive military operations will be less. This kind of things we heard during our study, especially 1 month and 1.5 months before the elections, when the junta make more military operations and airstrikes.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of wild to think that there's this hope that, you know, I hope this election that I know is fraudulent is successful for the military that I hate, because at the very least I hope that they will bomb us less as a result of that. It is a very perverse thing, and I find myself using that word more and more often as we discuss the realities on the ground in Myanmar. It's quite disturbing, to be honest. But you know, unfortunately, that is what the findings are. And again, for the audience, if anyone is interested, the report is entitled "Voting in Terror: Studying Myanmar's 2025 Election Through Community-Based Ethnography," conducted by Myanography. And I know that we are going to be going with a series of interviews to discuss more and more aspects of your research and more aspects of the election and the realities on the ground. So I think we have reached a logical concluding point for this episode, for this particular installment, but we will pick this up and we will continue this.
Yes. One, we study the elections ethnographically, what we call is community ethnography. We understand better that the junta, they don't have actually capacity or confidence, even though they use the mass destructive weapons and the bureaucratic mechanism, the puppet, no, bureaucratic mechanism, they don't have capacity. So that's why they use different ways of oppressions in order to get votes. But what we learn from the elections of research, this ethnographic research is this 2025 elections is more fake and more fraudulent than we are talking about in our everyday life. On the ground, when we study through this very ethnographic, community-based ethnography, we found out that it is much more fraudulent and much more fake than we initially thought. That's why anyone, any countries, any government who recognize the results of these elections, they are made fool. They are the fool. They are made fool by the junta. Thank you.
Many listeners know that in addition to offering these podcast episodes, we also run a nonprofit, Better Burma, which carries out humanitarian projects across Myanmar. While we regularly post about the current needs and proposals, we also have to handle emergency requests at times, often in matters that are quite literally life or death. When these urgent requests come in, funds are often needed within just hours, so there's no time really to conduct targeted fundraisers. For these situations, we try and maintain an emergency fund. So please consider specifically helping us to maintain this emergency fund. We want to stress that a donation of literally any amount allows us to respond more flexibly and effectively when disaster strikes. Discover how to donate at betterburma.org/donation.
Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,